A grant from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Programming on WILL AM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming families for the St. Petersburg State Ballet Theater's presentation of Romeo and Juliet, the National Acrobats of Taiwan, and Japan's Kodo Drummers. For more information, contact the Krannert Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit krannertcenter.com.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. In the first hour today, we'll be talking with novelist Gregory Maguire. He's the author of 4 novels for adults and more than a dozen novels for children. His adult novels are based on familiar stories, and they are stories that we tend to think of as children's stories. They are Wicked, The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West, which is inspired by the Oz stories. The others are Confessions of an Ugly Stepsister, and his latest, which is titled Mirror, Mirror, which is his take on the story of Snow White. Wicked, you may recognize, was the basis for a big-budget Broadway musical with music and lyrics by Stephen Schwartz. He was the creator of Godspell and Pippin. Confessions of an Ugly Stepsister was also filmed for television for ABC Disney, and that originally aired in the spring of 2002. He's also contributed reviews to the New York Times Book Review, the Boston Review, the Christian Science Monitor, and he's also a national figure in children's literature education. He was professor and associate director of the Center for the Study of Children's Literature at Simmons College from 1979 through 1986. Since 1986, he's been co-director and founding board member of the Children's Literature New England, Incorporated. It's a nonprofit that's interested in giving attention to the importance of literature in the lives of children. He holds a PhD in English and American Literature from Tufts University, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Perhaps also I should mention that if you're interested in reading his books, the novels for adults, they are all published by HarperCollins, and certainly you should be able to find them if you head out to the bookstore. Mr. Maguire, hello.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. And yourself?
I'm very well. Thank you.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. I think that one of the things that you find is that this particular story, Snow White, people will know, certainly they will know the Disney telling of this, or they may somehow know it as a story that's come to us from the Brothers Grimm. But the fact is that it's a story, a basic story that you will find in a lot of cultures. And while apparently some of the details will vary from one place to the next, the central theme of this, the thing that doesn't change, is that this is a story about conflict between an older woman and a younger woman. And in a lot of the versions, it's kind of a stepmother kind of a thing. But apparently also, in many cases, the woman, the older woman, is actually the biological mother of the Snow White figure. So that's this struggle between women is a constant in this story, and apparently you find it in lots of places. Is that something in particular that interested you, that you wanted to write about?
Well, I didn't think of it as I didn't think the fact that it's a struggle between women as being the most pertinent point of the story, although I agree with you, that is definitely part of what the story is about. I think of it more as being the struggle between generations. That is to say, there is a job that the older generation has to do if it is successfully to raise its young, and that is to be very honest with itself about how it is aging. The fact that the older generation needs to care for the young, but needs to make sure that they're ready to be the mature ones to take over when their time for control and power and authority has passed. I think Snow White is about many, many things. But one of the things it's about the lust for life that all of us feel that sometimes makes us pretend we are younger than we are and makes us reluctant to accept the facts of aging, and that it's our time to go sit by the fire and let somebody else do the bills and bring in the harvest.
Oh, well, that's interesting. I guess I didn't really think about it that way. Of course, that is something that seems to be very common now that it's the idea of aging, the idea of getting older, certainly the idea of looking older is something that we just don't like. And there's an enormous industry that's dedicated to helping people feel younger, look younger, selling them the idea that if you take this pill, you're going to live forever. And I don't think that that's just something that's designed to appeal to women at all. It just appeals to everybody.
I completely agree. If you look in a mirror, you don't need the mirror to be magic in order for it to tell you the truth of what you see. The mirror is looking back at you. And if the mirror is saying, there's a young person down the block who has a thinner waistline and more beautiful, luxurious hair, that's part of what the mirror is saying, but the mirror is also saying, and you don't. And to be honest, the mirror speaks honestly to us. It is hard to take sometimes.
I think it's also interesting that the setting that you've chosen for this, because you've set it in Italy, and there certainly is an Italian version of this story. You've set it in the period of warring states, which is maybe one of the more interesting and more colorful periods in Italian history. What about that time interests you?
Well, let me tell you a little bit about how I go about this work of I don't really consider these retellings of fairy tales, but I consider them interpretations or embellishments, perhaps. When I considered the original Snow White, that is the Grimm version, and the Disney version, which is the one most of us know, I thought, what are the irreducible elements of this story? To resemble or to evoke a Snow White idea in any reader's mind, what must a story have? It must have a mirror. It must have a stepmother or a mother, as you say, and a younger woman, a daughter. It must have an apple, because the whole story is recognized by the poison apple. And it probably should have a dwarf. Maybe it could get away without the dwarf, but I should have at least one dwarf, some garden gnome or other. If you take all that, and you think those are the irreducible elements. If I could set an apple, a mirror, and a dwarf in Weimar, Germany, and it would be Snow White. I could set an apple, a mirror, and a dwarf in the Twin Towers on September 11th, 2001, and it would be Snow White. Mm-hmm. Wherever you put those three elements, it will make people think of Snow White. So what is it about those elements put together? What do they say? The apple, I've already talked a little bit about what I think the mirror says. Mirror says, be honest about your station in the world, especially about giving over to the young and accepting aging and perhaps accepting the wisdom that comes with aging. What does the apple say? To me, the apple says a number of things, but the first thing it says is the garden of knowledge, the garden of good and evil, the fruit of good and evil. It says that we all thirst after that bite that will make us know more, be more, live more capably. So that apple suggests to me that the story is a little bit about growing up into knowledge. Hmm. Now,
go ahead. I shouldn't have interrupted. Go ahead.
I try not to be so prolix, but I'm just this is my wedge into why then Italy in the early 16th century, because Italy in the early 16th century is where the High Renaissance has its first flowering, where the light of reason begins to glow over the landscape, and the darker shadows of superstition begin to recede just a little bit. It is the culture itself that's waking up and wanting to revel in the knowledge that is capable of reveling in. So that's why the setting, and the setting derives from what I think the story is about.
Yeah. Let me again reintroduce our guest. We're talking with Gregory Maguire. He's a novelist who's written novels both for grown-ups and for children, and his novels for adults are based upon familiar stories. And as he says, he doesn't really think of this as retelling of fairy tales for adults, but indeed they are based on familiar stories that we think of as children's stories, including Cinderella and Snow White, and his most recent is titled Mirror, Mirror, and that is sort of his take on the story of Snow White. There's also a book titled Confessions of an Ugly Stepsister. That would be Cinderella. And then also his book Wicked, The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West, which was not in the recent past, was basis for a big a Broadway musical. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think just the point where I was stumbling there and interrupting you, I guess that I was thinking about the apple, and I think it is interesting. Again, apparently in other, the thing that's sort of common about these stories is the poisoning element, and it's not all, the apple is not always the agent, but we in this versions that we know, it is the apple, and you do make that connection between, you know, what do we think of when we think apple? Well, we think Garden of Eden, obviously, the tree, the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And I guess, again, that's one of the things that, that happens once Snow White takes the bite of the apple. Yes, the story goes from there, but that, it seems that that is also sort of a symbolic crossing point between childhood, for her, between childhood and adulthood.
That's absolutely true. She dies as a child,
right,
in a sense, and when she is awakened by the kiss of a passing prince, it's not child molestation. She's an adult. She's ready to wake up into her new life. In a way, that in a way, it's a parable. I deeply believe it's also a parable about the actual garden of good and evil, about Adam and Eve, and that when they ate the apple, they sinned according to Christian thinking, but they also woke up into a new, a different, perhaps a corrupted, but a full and different life. It was a transformational moment for them and for the culture.
Hmm. We, as I've said a couple of times, we tend to think of these stories, the stories like Snow White and Cinderella and the others, as being children's stories. And certainly if you go back into the oral tradition, we get to a time when these are not just children's stories. They're stories for everybody. What have we lost, do you think, by dismissing these stories as being something for children and saying, well, there's nothing here for a grown-up to appreciate?
Well, it is. I think the stories work as little moral equations. Let's face it, they're so portable. They're so small. They're so old that they're not like you know, the Odyssey. You can carry around the story of Snow White in your pocket and tell it in 3 minutes to a fractious child who needs to use the bathroom. You need to keep them concentrating on something else for a minute. They're small. They're portable. Because they're so old, they've been boiled down. They're very potent. But if we only give them to children, if we take out any suggestion that the true danger that does lurk in the world, let's face it, we all know it does, if we take out any suggestion of that, then we denature them. We make them into eunuchs, in a sense. They're not their full being. What they give to adults is something like what a parable from the Gospels gives to adults, or something like what a beautiful bit of poetry that you can take out and hold in a moment of crisis or in a moment of reflection to still your thinking and to concentrate your attentions. They are wonderful little portable baubles by which we can remember who we are and remember how hard it is to be alive and be a good person in the difficult world.
We have a caller to talk with. Let's do that. Someone listening this morning in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm very interested in this program, but I have a question about, is it a coincidence or are you just interested in stories that focus on women characters? I mean, the three books, the three pieces I've heard mentioned so far all focus on, you know, mother, daughter, wicked witch, that kind of thing, and I'm wondering what your fascination is with women characters, and are you trying to make a larger point about the role of women in the larger world, or what's up with all that?
Well, that's a wonderful question, and thank you for it. In fact, there are two ways to answer it. And the glib way, in which I say, well, basically women are more interesting, so they are more complex thinkers. They are more likely to change their minds because they deal with taking in new information more quickly than men do. That's kind of glib, but I also think it's kind of true in my experience. Mm. So therefore, as a novelist, a main character who's a woman just is much more capable. It's like having somebody who can sing and dance and speak in languages for hire rather than somebody who can only dance.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, So that's glib and swift, but it's also true. On the other hand, so many stories about domestic situations have to hinge on what a woman does, mm-hmm. how a woman behaves in the domain that up until fairly recently was considered her only domain.
Mm-hmm.
That is the four walls of the household, or maybe the nearer fields in the farm, and the nearer bushes of berries, and the nearer stream for laundry. It's a small world. That too makes it a kind of convenient world for a novelist to walk around.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's a bit bogus now, of course, but we all remember what it's like to be young, to be for the four walls of our, you know, of our little house, to be basically what the world was.
Mm-hmm.
And the person at the head of that world may have been the father nominally. The father was often out of the house in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And the real person in charge, everybody knew, was the goddess,
mm-hmm.
the mommy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a person who was raised in a large family, a complicated family. I won't go into that right now, maybe later. But being able to see the power, capacity, moral breadth, humor, imagination of a person, in this case, you know, say the woman at the head of my household is raising seven children without much money to do it, well, what is not to applaud and learn from in that kind of wonderful situation?
Mm-hmm.
So I am drawn to women characters.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're riveting, and they always surprise me on the page. Every time I think I know what they're going to do, I turn the page over, and my hand says, "She slammed the door." I think, "She slammed the door? Why'd she do that? I thought she was happy. What's up with that?" And so the characters themselves tend to sort of lead me through the realities of their situations. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it's very okay. Good. I just noticed that, you know, with all the attention on Lord of the Rings series, you know, we have these men and all epic stories, that it's just interesting to hear about someone who's interested in the other side of that.
Well, it's a wonderful parallel. And just think about it. I've just finished watching The Lord of the Rings on DVD because I didn't see it. I have small children at home, so I never go to the movies. But look, in order to get that story going, I mean, at the very beginning, they got to shake those hobbits out of their house.
Mm-hmm.
They got to shake them out of the hole. Nothing's going to happen to them unless they get out of the house,
mm-hmm.
and start marching across the landscape without women.
Mm-hmm.
And so if it's a story all about men, it's going to be about high drama and world-shaking good and evil, when we all know perfectly well that though that's true and real and not to be sniffed down upon, that the woman hobbit who's left back in the hole, if there ever were any, maybe there were any, teaching the 3-year-old hobbit the difference between good and evil is just as earth-shaking,
mm-hmm.
just as important.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that deeply. But it's a different kind of story to tell.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you
well,
for your question.
Thank you for the call. And others are welcome to 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana folks, and also toll-free 800-222-9455. In the book, we talked a little bit about, well, first of all, people know the story, and we talked a little bit about the setting. For the opposite number here, for the evil stepmother figure, you have chosen, and I don't know if this comes out of the fact that the time that you chose to write about, or that there's this poisoning motif, but you have selected one of the most famous, almost semi-legendary figures of the Italian Renaissance who is associated with poisoning, and that is Lucrezia Borgia. Why her?
Well, I can't honestly tell you whether she occurred to me first, and then I figured out that the High Renaissance would be the right place for the story, or whether I thought of the High Renaissance first and then began to read up on it, on the major characters of the Renaissance, came upon her and thought, aha, of course. I don't remember in which direction my mind worked, but once you get to Lucrezia Borgia, you can't let her go. She is probably the most famous poisoner in literary and actual history. I mean, there are poisonings in Romeo and Juliet and, you know, a few others, but boy, she was good at it. She and her family, her brother Cesare Borgia and her father Pope Alexander VI, were dab hands, or said to be, at poisoning their enemies. They poisoned their partners. They poisoned their partners' husbands. They poisoned their partners, husbands, boyfriends. They, you know, they went all the way up and down the block. It was like a reverse trick or treat. They were wonderful at it, or so their enemies said. Once you get that, you think, goodness, here's a woman, Lucrezia Borgia. She is beautiful. If you've seen, there are about five or six portraits of her extant, and you can look them up on in histories of the time. She's absolutely splendid, and her father is the Pope. That you can't get a novelistic character better placed to do evil than somebody who's the daughter of the head of Christendom. It's too rich. I couldn't make up anything bad about Lucrezia that her enemies had not already made up about her. One of my siblings, who is a member of a church that is slightly stricter than the church to which I belong, said to me, without approbation particularly, but just with interest, there are sections of this book that are quite foul. And she lowered her eyebrows at me, and I said, Annie, I think I know the sections you're talking about, and I want to tell you, if you think that it's my imagination that's come up with that section or those two sections, think again. That was what people were saying about each other during the Renaissance. All I did was read about the Renaissance and take such parts as were pertinent to put in my story in order to create the picture of a really rotten character. So there's little that a novelist needs to do once he stumbles upon Lucrezia Borgia. Oh, she's gorgeous. Oh, she's bad.
Well, she certainly is a great character. And she, interestingly enough, she's a woman, even though she was a member of a very powerful family, she was a woman and was forced to use what God gave her as tools to get what she wanted, which is something that we seem to have really mixed feelings about that, whether that is appropriate or whether that is inevitable, that women should use their bodies, essentially,
yes,
to get what they want.
Right. Is it cunning or is it sensible? Exactly. Or is it both? Maybe it's both. She streaked her hair with lemon juice and sat on the sun to make it blonder. This is in 1502. Isn't that a wonderful thing to know? She was also, at the age of 19, named by her father the governess, that is, the governor, of the town of Spoleto, which was a military stronghold in central Italy. So, beautiful as she was, accomplished as she was, she also had, sort of like Scarlett O'Hara, she had an interest in knowing how men used power. And when she was the governatrice of Spoleto, she was good at it. And she was only retired because she got pregnant, and her father wanted to make sure that she bore the child to full term. Mm. So she was taken out of the post. Have we ever heard of that before? I don't know.
We are at our midpoint here in this part of Focus 580. Our guest, Gregory Maguire. He is the author of a number of novels for both adults and also for children. His adult novels, all based on familiar stories. They are Wicked, The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West. That was published in 1995 and was the basis for a Broadway musical. Also, Confessions of an Ugly Stepsister and recently Mirror, Mirror. He has written book reviews for a number of publications, New York Times Book Review, The Boston Review, The Christian Science Monitor. He's also very interested in children's literature. He was professor and associate director of the Center for the Study of Children's Literature at Simmons College for a number of years between 1979 and 1986. And questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, it seems that in a lot of these stories that also another feature, in addition to being in many cases, the absent mother, that is the absent biological mother. We have the sort of good, well-meaning, but kind of ineffectual father. And I wonder how you feel about Vicente, the man who is the father of the girl in the story, whose name is Bianca. She is the Snow White figure, who through no desire of his own, is absent from home and so leaves his daughter to the tender mercies of Lucrezia. He's sent off on a mission by her brother Cesare, and he truly has no choice in this. And yet he's the man that has done everything he can basically to keep his head down so that he does not come to the notice of the people who are engaged in all this fighting back and forth at the period. What he just wants is to live a quiet life, to have his, essentially he's a farmer in a glorified way, and he just wants to live peacefully, out of the way of trouble, to take care of his little girl and basically live his life, and the Borgias come along and make trouble for him. But something about him is a little bit unsatisfying. But I guess in a lot of these stories, the fathers really aren't, they're really not very solid or very reliable figures. I wonder how you feel about the father in this story.
Well, I will answer that question by going back and filling in a tiny bit of my own biography, because I think it's effective as a way to consider this character of Vicente. One of the reasons I'm so interested in fairy tales, I suppose, is that my mother died in childbirth when I was born. That's the beginning of every fairy tale, basically. It doesn't happen very often, and I'm now 50 years old, and as far as I know, that was the last death by childbirth in the city in which I was raised for the last 50 years. But I was first taken care of by relatives, and then I was in an orphanage, and until my father, whose health was poor, could remarry a wonderful woman who raised me, my stepmother, I was shunted from pillar to post. Raised by my stepmother with my other siblings and with the children she went on to have with my father, her first husband, I was very interested, of course, in family dynamics. Who does what, and how does a family work when its mother, its maternal goddess, is dead and there's somebody who has to stand in and do the job? Well, it could work very well, but you look at fairy tales, the dead mother is always the saint, and the working mother, the mother who's actually got to get food on the table and worry about whether the roof is leaking, always ends up being the villainess, always ends up being the Lucrezia Borgia, always ends up being the wicked stepmother trying to put her own children forward at the expense of her adopted children. And the father, where's the father? He's usually absent. He has to be absent in order for the strong dynamic between the working mother and the lonely grieving child to be effective. In Mirror, Mirror, as you point out, Vicente de Nevada, Bianca's father, has to be off stage in order for Lucrezia to be able to get her talons into the beauty of Bianca in order to try to murder her and send her off the estate. But I was not content to make him be entirely offstage. I thought, I want to follow him. He must have a story, too. He is offstage not as in some fairy tales, because he's just not paying attention or because he's drunk or ineffectual. He's offstage because it's the only way he knows how to protect his child, even from a distance. I don't want to give away the plot at all, but I will say, at the very end of the book, the father comes back. This is not what you usually see at the end of a fairy tale. At the end of a fairy tale, which is the story of maturation, the child is supposed to have transferred affections and attentions from the father, the mother, to the prince or the princess. That's what maturing is about. It's about leaving the family home and finding a home of your own, making a home of your own. But I could not leave my father out there in the wilderness and my daughter, even if she's grown up and mature, continually bereaving the loss of both parents. So I brought the father back on the last page. Now, I have three children. They are adopted. I've adopted them because I love children, and I've adopted them because I wanted to pay honor both to my mother who died in childbirth and to my stepmother who sacrificed a great deal in order to give me a healthy and happy life. I now have a daughter. She's 3.5 years old. Someday, I hope I'm still alive, she will read this book, and I could not write the end of this novel now that I'm the father of a daughter without making sure that the father and the daughter were reunited.
Well, let's talk with someone else here. We have another caller here locally in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yes, fascinating interplay between the author's life and the way he views domestic tales. I wanted to ask the author if he has kept this same kind of interplay in his children's books, and could he talk more about his children's books?
Thank you very much. I'd be delighted to. I suppose the interplay between the facts of my own domestic biography and the work that I've done for adults is more obvious because the fairy tales are so very rich. You scratch them with your fingernail and they're redolent of the ages. The books that I've written for children are generally more lighthearted, not exclusively, but generally. I am known for a series of 7 comic novels called The Hamlet Chronicles. I'm talking with Nickelodeon at the moment about making them into a Saturday morning series. We'll see if that happens. But The Hamlet Chronicles are set in a small town in Vermont, and they are about a bunch of kids for whom, to whom strange visitors come, one per book. Sometimes it's space aliens, sometimes it's poisonous spiders from beyond the dawn of time, sometimes it's genetic mutations, sometimes it's cupids from Greece. Different visitors come into town, stir things up a little bit. The children always have to solve the problem, and they always do. Somebody who was doing a long, extended biography of me once pointed out that every single visitor to town was lacking a mother, and I hadn't seen it. And I thought, oh, even in the very comic writing that I do, it's almost as if there has to be a dead mother in the background in order for a situation to occur to me as being legitimately a story. In 7 Spiders Spinning, the spider's mother is eaten by a penguin on page 1. In 4 Stupid Cupids, the Cupids are being babysat, and the mother's gone off to Mount Olympus to have a glass of wine with Zeus. It's comic, and it's ridiculous, but how extraordinary. For people in the listening audience who might consider that they like to write or that they have stories that they want to tell, it would be an interesting exercise to think, what is the condition in which a story that I might tell could take place? Is it the condition of a family with a missing mother, which seems to be my set condition? Is it the condition of something else? If you can perhaps know where the stresses and releases are in your own, you know, deep brain structure, your own deep thinking and feeling structure, if you've sensed that, that might be a good clue to you about where to start sniffing around for your own story to tell.
What other books besides that series have you written?
Well, I wrote a book called Missing Sisters, and what is it about? It's about twins who given up for adoption, who are 12 years old. They don't know they're twins because one of them was adopted when she was 1 and the other was left behind in the Catholic orphanage. They're identical twins, and they discover each other by accident halfway through the book. I've also written a story called The Good Liar, which is a story set in France during World War II about a family of 3 boys who have... Actually, this is a bit of a difference for me. It's actually a missing father. The father's gone off to fight in the war, and the 3 boys are living at home with their mother. And they have a competition to see who is the most effective liar. It turns out that it's not any of the 3 boys, but somebody else in the plot who has lied so well that they have been fooled. But it's a serious story about the morality of lying and about how sometimes the rules with which we're raised must be broken in order to save human life.
What are the ages that are appropriate for these children's books?
I call myself a novelist for children, or for middle-aged readers. For middle-aged children readers. By that, mm-hmm. I mean children who are reading chapter books. Maybe 3rd grade if the children are good readers, or fourth or fifth if they're reading to grade level, mm-hmm. up to about eighth grade. They're not as fat and dense and complicated as Harry Potter, but they are chapter books with relatively few illustrations, and they're available, and most of them are available in paperback, too. So they're...
And tell me your name again, sir.
My name is Maguire, M-A-G-U-I-R-E. It's like I was very happy when the movie Jerry Maguire came out, because everybody, for about 6 months, everybody could spell my last name.
And your first name?
My first name is Gregory.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Right. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for the call. We have about 20 minutes left in this part of the show with Gregory Maguire. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about the dwarves in your book, particularly. I think this idea of the dwarves, first of all, as being cute and having individual, distinct personalities, at least, comes from Disney. I think if you go back to the Grimm version of the story, the dwarfs don't even have names. They're just the first dwarf, the second dwarf, the third dwarf. And you have done, again, something interesting because your dwarves are, they do have names. They're kind of strange. They do have personalities. They're a little strange. And in fact, for you, the dwarfs are something like a force of nature. I guess I'm still sort of trying to figure out what the exact nature of the dwarfs is, because there's in some sense in which they are real and yet not.
Well, you're exactly right, and you have described it beautifully. What I started with was the knowledge that any adult who picked up my novel Mirror, Mirror would come to it, or at least any American reader, would come to it with the pictures in their minds of Doc and Grumpy and Sneezy and so on in their heads. Those are wonderfully comic characters. But, as you point out, in the original stories, the dwarves weren't individualized. In fact, to individualize them was to give them a slightly different function in the story than had been originally intended. So I needed to particularize my characters a little bit, because I knew that would be expected. But I also wanted to confound and confuse the reader so they would know they were not in Disneyland by any stretch of the imagination. My dwarves are creatures that are almost like veins of mineral or rock running through the soil. Just as in any culture, our culture sits upon the cultures of the centuries that went before us. We sometimes can't see it, but the effects of those cultures resonate through in our laws, in our language, in our superstitions, in our habits and customs. So too, these dwarves are like the bedrock upon which the Italian Renaissance is happening. They are magic, they are powerful, they are a force like Mother Nature or Mother Earth. But they too, like Bianca de Nevada and like the Italian Renaissance, are trying to grow, to mature, to become something new. They're trying to become something a little bit like a human being. So they can have names, they do have names, but their characteristics are murky, peculiar, and indeed they don't always even settle upon the same dwarf each time. The characteristics are kind of shared from time to time and run around between them until finally toward the end of the novel they begin to settle into themselves, into the people that they will be once the story is over.
Mm. We have someone else to talk with. Caller listening in the southern LaSalle County. So let's go there on our toll-free line, line 4.
Hello.
Yes, hello.
I'm taking advantage of you because of your interest. When I was in first or second grade in public school, they had Rumpelstiltskin, and then they had that tale about the animals that were looking in, and they were one on top of the other.
Oh, yes, right.
Okay, but what I want to know, I have never heard another person say about the Hobyazzle Getcher. What is that?
Say that word again, the what?
The Hobyazzle Getcher.
The Hobyazzle. Now, I have never heard of that either, but I wonder two things. I wonder where you heard that in your childhood, and is that...
Well, it was in the book, in the reading book.
Oh, it was in the Hobyazzle.
The Hobyazzle will get you.
Interesting. Well, I wonder whether... I've heard a phrase, the goblins will get you, And that's like a cross between the word goblins and gobble up, like gobble up. But Habyas sounds quite a bit like that kind of word, don't you think? It sounds like a swallow, like Habya. It sounds like a big mouth sound swallowed by a swallowing sound. The Habyas will get you. You're going to be eaten up. If you don't eat up your dinner, the Habyas are going to come and eat you up.
I don't remember the story at all, but I just remember the Habyas will get you.
I rather like that, actually. I'm writing that down as we speak, the Habyas. Isn't that interesting?
Thank you very much, and I'm really enjoying this. I never expected to, but I am.
Well, my pleasure. I'm delighted you are, and I hope you have a chance to take a look at the book.
Well, thank you for the call. And once again, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest is Gregory Maguire. He's a novelist written for both adults and children. And again, his novels for adults based on things that we think of as children's stories, or at least would be familiar stories, including Wicked, The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West, Confessions of an Ugly Stepsister, and his most recent, it's titled Mirror, Mirror, and it is his sort of his take on the story of Snow White. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. I was thinking a little bit about the way that you talked about the dwarves and also their function in the story as her rescuers and her protectors. And I'm thinking about what it means that for her to seek shelter and also the place where this transformation occurs when she goes from being a child to being an adult is in the forest. So it means going away from civilization. And it means going and seeking out the help of these dwarves that they're kind of outcasts in a way. They're certainly not human, and they're not, they wouldn't be likely be accepted in human society. I mean, what does it mean that in this story, and maybe a lot of these stories, that the person has to be removed, either remove themselves or have somehow forcefully removed from everyday life?
Well, it's a little bit, I mean, you're absolutely right. Since my story takes place in the age of the Renaissance, that was when the great city-states of Italy were coming up and Florence was becoming Florence, not just a town, but a force on the political map, and Naples had a king, and Venice ruled the Adriatic. So in order for the story to concentrate on the development, the domestic development of a child and get away from the political map, it does have to take place outside of the city walls, in a sense, in a forest. Stephen Sondheim has that play called Into the Woods. It has to be a place apart from the courts of justice and apart from the prying eyes of the public, but a place where a protagonist meets, in a sense, his or her interior self and wrestles with the demons that need to be controlled in order to move on to a greater state of maturity. In North American Indian lore, Native American lore, as I understand it, a great many of the clans and cultures and tribes had a sort of, you might call it a bar mitzvah. There was a rite of passage whereby a young man wanting to prove he was ready to mature and move into his adult state would go away from the encampment and go into the wilderness and live alone, whether for an overnight or make a trek or make a pilgrimage, and then come back having survived being alone and having made that transformation. One of the things that he was doing probably psychologically was just realizing that he was intact and separate and whole and entire and could survive. Once he realizes that, he's then ready to be a mature adult. So a lot of the fairy tales do take place on the margins, beyond the threshold of the house, beyond the castle, out in the woods. In the case of Mirror, Mirror, it's not just the woods, it's kind of a cave almost. Bianca Nevada goes to the house of the dwarves that is as much like a cave underground as it is like a little thatched roof cottage with fire merrily poking about in the fireplace.
Let's talk again with someone else. Gibson City, next, line number one. Hello.
Hello. want to thank Mr. McGuire for his books. I've read Wicked and Confessions, and I look forward to reading Mirror, Mirror.
Thank you.
The reason that I called is that Wicked, my younger daughter, introduced me to, and she and I were both blown away by Elphaba's character. Abigail was born with spina bifida. She's in a wheelchair, and like Elphaba, she is different and can't hide that difference. And as I was reading it, I thought, this is Abigail. You have captured my daughter.
Wow.
She has that same, she takes on the world, asks no quarter, and gives no quarter. But underneath, you know, or actually even on top of it, she's, you know, she's a wonderful, wonderful person. But in reading it, I was astounded at how you, in many ways, captured her essence, and she was too.
Well, I'm sitting here in my home in Massachusetts with chills running up and down the sides of my arms. So that's the greatest compliment I could receive in the course of a month, and I'm very pleased that your daughter recognized Elphaba, and I have no doubt that Elphaba would recognize your daughter.
I have no doubt at all.
I see the character of Elphaba, which is my way of saying the Wicked Witch of the West. That's who it is, the character played by Margaret Hamilton in the famous 1939 film invented by L. Frank Baum. I see her as, in a way, my alter ego. I'm not as brave, probably, as your daughter, I suspect. So I created Elphaba as a way, partly to give myself courage, to think, were I as outspoken and as strong-minded as this character, I should be very proud of myself. So I have no doubt you're very proud of your daughter.
Oh, absolutely.
How wonderful.
As I am of my other children.
Well, that's just great. You know, I'll tell you, Wicked, of course, is running to full houses on Broadway and has been doing so for over a year. And when the green-skinned witch comes onto stage, people stand and scream and cheer. It's almost like a rock concert. It's so exciting. But after, when the CD was released just about a year ago now, I went down to New York and sat in the Gershwin Theater where the composer and many of the stars who were playing on the Broadway opening were sitting in the lobby signing CDs for about 3 hours. 500 people lined up to buy CDs and get them signed. And about every 14th person, I would guess, was a young woman between the ages of, say, 16 and 32. And many of them were Asian or Black or mixed race or Native American. And about every 14th person, the star, Idina Menzel, who later went on to win the Tony for Best Performance, had to stand and throw her arms around a weeping young woman who was so excited because Idina Menzel had portrayed so well the character of the Wicked Witch of the West, my Elphaba. And I sat about seven steps up on the sidelines where nobody could see me with tears streaming down my face to be so glad that my character meant so much to so many people. So I take a deep amount of honor from what you've shared, and I'm very grateful.
Well, the honor goes on. She has named her car, which is a green car. It's a Saab, so it has its peculiarities. she named it Elphaba.
Well, I'm delighted. I have tried.
Thank you for writing those books.
Thank you so much. Please give. Let me ask you one more question, if you don't mind. If this isn't confidential, and if it is, you certainly don't need to answer. But I'm curious about how old your daughter was when she read this book, because there's a big question about whether my books are for young adults or for adults.
She is 26, so she was, I don't remember whether she read it after her birthday or before, but 25, 26.
Oh, okay. That, I think, is quite legitimate. I do hesitate. Many, many, many teenagers are reading Wicked, particularly. I mean, they're reading my other books, too.
Yeah.
But Wicked, particularly, was not intended for a teenage audience. And I don't mind that people read it as long as their parents are comfortable with it. But yeah. When people ask me, do I recommend it, I say, no. If I had intended it to be read by a teenage audience, I would have published it as a teenage novel. The fact that it's read by teenagers is outside my control, but that doesn't mean that I particularly endorse it or recommend it. It's on lots of high school reading recommended lists, but that's for the high school to determine, not for the author to determine. But thank you for answering that.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Very good.
Thank you for writing.
We're almost to the point where we're going to have to stop. I'm curious, Mr. McGuire, what are you working on now?
Well, we talked a little bit about absent mothers, and we talked a little bit about the absence of male characters in my adult novels. And I am now writing another adult novel. The first one for whom the central character is a young man, and it is a sequel to Wicked. It is the story of the boy that Elphaba the Witch leaves behind when she dies in that castle in the west of Oz. His name is Lear, L-I-I-R, and it follows him for about 10 years, from the time he's 14 till the time he's 24. And so, as a sequel, of course, of Wicked, The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West, the book can have no other title but Son of a Witch.
Well, I wish you the best. And for people who are listening, of course, you can head out to the bookstore and you can look for the books by our guest, Gregory McGuire, including Mirror, Mirror, the one we've talked a bit about here this morning, spelled by Regan, which is a HarperCollins imprint. And all of the others are in print, too. If you want to read Wicked, The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West, and Confessions of an Ugly Stepsister, they are all out there. And Mr. McGuire, we just want to say thanks very much. We certainly appreciate you talking with us.
I have had a wonderful time this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Very good. Our show, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. The broadcast is also made possible with support from Orange Taxi. It's a new taxi company providing services to the University of Illinois campus and the Champaign-Urbana area 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at 367-8888. Coming up later today as part of the Afternoon Magazine, we will sample some of the wit and wisdom of America's great comedy teams. Celeste Quinn is the host for the show. She'll be talking with Lawrence Epstein. He's professor of English at Suffolk Community College and is author of a book entitled Mixed Nuts, America's Love Affair with Comedy Teams from Burns and Allen to Belushi and Aykroyd. That'll be in the 1 o'clock hour of the show. The program gets underway at noon, with usual mix of news and sports and other things. Celeste Quinn is the host. In the next hour of this show, we'll be inviting your healthcare questions. We'll be doing the show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor every other month. We welcome to the program Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician from Carl Clinic to take your questions. That's in just a bit. We'll have news at 1 minute past the hour. First, though, an update on the market, so stay tuned.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operations,